Shore Sheen Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Well, hello everyone, this is Bill, and this is our Torah commentary on the Torah portion called Tzav. And Tzav means command. This is taken from Leviticus, or Vayikra, chapter 6, verse 1, through chapter 8, verse 36. Now, as we covered in the previous Torah portion, Vayikra, we see that the first five chapters were addressed to the children of Israel and how they were to bring their offerings. What we see in this Torah portion, these are instructions that are addressing the priests themselves. And of course, the instructions that were given to the priest are going to affect the entire nation. Nevertheless, this is more or less a manual for the priest concerning different sacrifices. Now, the sacrifices that are covered are the same ones that are covered previously, with just a few additional details that are going to pertain to the priest. Now, the fact that the text uses the word Torah to describe these instructions is to suggest that in these instructions that it's very important that the priests follow them to the letter. As I said, the name of the portion is Tzav, spelled Tzadeh Vav, and that is a word that means to command. And this is related to a word that perhaps most of you are familiar with, and that is mitzvah, because we understand that a mitzvah is an instruction, something that we are to do or to abstain from, whatever the case may be. And the reason we bring that out is previous to this, when these instructions were given, it was always, or almost always, preceded with words like, speak unto the children of Israel, or say unto the sons of Jacob, what have you. Where here we see that Moses is to tzav, he is to command the priests in what they are to do. And so this word emphasizes the extreme importance in doing these things the right way. And of course, the fact that at times some did not do things specifically the way they were told to do, that is going to be accentuated in the very next Torah portion. But now, as we begin in chapter 6, we see more instructions concerning the burnt offering, the olah, and the meal offering, the mincha. And in verse 2, it tells us or instructs us in the law of the burnt offering. Now, in this particular case, it's going to be distinct from the individual burnt offering that was discussed in the previous Torah portion. This is going to be dealing with the continual offering that was brought each morning and every evening. And this particular burnt offering that it's discussing here is going to be on behalf of the entire community. And again, that is going to be brought in the morning, and it's going to be brought in the evening. And that it was perpetual gives us its name in Hebrew, tamid, ongoing, perpetual, doesn't stop, every day, tamid. And so the evening offering would burn through the night until the priest came in the morning. And when the priest would come in the morning, before he could offer the next olah, or the next burnt offering for the morning, he had to first remove the ashes from the previous day's offerings. And of course, those ashes were carried outside the camp, and the Torah portion tells us to a clean place. By the way, this clean place is the same clean place where the bull for the HaKohen HaMashiach was burned. You remember, if you listened to our Torah portion on Vayikra, there was a special offering that was for the anointed priest, it says, but in Hebrew it's HaKohen HaMashiach. And that bullock was to be taken outside the camp and to be burned in a clean place. Well, that clean place is, again, the same place where these ashes were carried from the preceding day's sacrifices. So, just a footnote, more or less, but to kind of put those things together. Now, the offering of the olah in the morning and in the evening, this perpetual offering, the tamid, actually became a national institution. And as such, later on, the leaders of Israel believed that everybody in the whole nation should be able to participate in this continual burning, this olah, because of the blessing that comes as a result of it. And so we see that the entire nation, in order to participate in this, that developed into the priest being divided up into 24 priestly courses. In fact, in the Mishkan, we see that Aaron and his sons were the ones that were ministering. They were pretty much on duty all the time. But later on, as the priesthood began to grow and the family began to grow, so to speak, they were able to divide the priesthood up into these 24 courses. And so the point is that was in part put into place so that the whole nation, through these different courses, could participate in these burnt offerings, the tamid. And again, it's because it was considered to be something of a national institution. They wanted all the people to be able to be blessed in the sense that they were actually participating. Of course, it was the Levites who were doing it, but the point was is that all these different Levites throughout the country, divided up into these courses, would come and serve a week, and usually through the year it ends up being 2 weeks, but at any rate, they could participate in that manner. The point is that the tamid offering eventually plays a role in leading to the 24 different courses of the priesthood. Now, in verse 5, we see that the fire of the altar is not to go out, that it was to burn continually without ceasing. And of course, if you've got an offering being burned on the altar in the morning, and you've got another one that's going to be burned in the evening, and that's going to burn through the night, then of course that's going to contribute to this continual burning, but that's also providing the reason for it to be continually burning as well. And so by the means of these two daily burnt offerings, we have a fire that is not to go out. Now, what's interesting to me on this is that even on Shabbat, the fuel, that is the wood, was to be placed upon the altar so that this fire would be continual. Here's why I find that interesting. Because there is a law not to kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on Shabbat. But apparently that law didn't apply to the sanctuary. In fact, let me go one further. The priests worked on Shabbat. That is, they went and performed their duties on Shabbat in the sanctuary. So in a sense, on the surface, it would seem that you got the scripture saying, don't do this on Shabbat. And then you see in the sanctuary, they were, quote unquote, working. You're not to kindle a fire on Shabbat, but you know, in Shabbat we see that the fire was continually being stoked. The wood was being provided. Do we have a contradiction? I don't think so, because what I believe it really is getting at is this, that to cease and desist, that is Shabbat, every seventh day, is to cease from the activities that are in your interest. In other words, that are going to benefit you economically, financially, those kinds of things, the toil, the work that's going to benefit you in that sense that you can better yourself by working in this way. Whereas the work, if I can put it that way, that went on in the sanctuary was to benefit all of Israel as far as the relationship with the Creator. So I don't see a contradiction in that. I just see that perhaps, and I say perhaps, some of the views on Shabbat have missed the point. In other words, ceasing from work is one thing, but ceasing from doing the things that will contribute to your spiritual welfare is another. So anyway, the fact is that the fire burned continually, even on Shabbat, and on Shabbat the priests went about their duties. Now in verse 6, this continual fire, like the Ner Tamid, and the Ner Tamid was the eternal light, the lamp of the menorah that was never to be extinguished. This continual fire on the altar is viewed as being a witness of Israel's mandate. And of course, Israel's mandate is to be a light to the nations and to be the witness of the one true God. And so this lamp on the menorah was never to be extinguished. This fire on the altar was to never go out. It was to be perpetual. Now the Midrash says and observes that this particular altar was in use for 116 years. And they break it down for us. They say 39 was in the wilderness, 14 years was in Gilgal, 13 years in Nob, and then 50 years in Gibeon, 116 years. And they make this observation, that in all of those years, the copper layer never melted, and the wooden component never charred, even though there had been a continual fire for 116 years. That's a footnote, more or less, but I find that to be a very, very interesting footnote. Thought you might as well. Now, in verses 10 through 11 of chapter 6, we see that of the part of the mincha, that is the meal offering, that is not burned, of the part that's not consumed in the flames, it was given to the priests as their portion. And the reason we're bringing this out is, as you continue to read, you will see that any food that come in contact with that, or any holy food for that matter, it could be the meal of the meal offering, it could be of these other offerings that involve flesh. Nevertheless, any food that came in contact with quote-unquote holy food itself became holy. In other words, again, if some kind of food came in contact with this that had been deemed holy, then it would be deemed holy as well. And the reason I find this so interesting is when you consider the prohibition against mingling holy and profane, and yet you've got a situation here where something that perhaps is not necessarily considered to be profane, but nevertheless is common, coming in contact with something holy, then that makes it holy. And rabbinical sources say that this principle is based on the idea that vessels, and I want to use that word, well, let's say it this way. We're talking about earthly vessels, you know, we're talking about clay pots, we're talking about metal pots and things like that. But then let's also consider vessels in the sense that you and I are to be vessels, servants to God. So at any rate, the principle that something that was not considered holy coming in contact with something that was holy then is made holy, again, is based on the principle that vessels can absorb the taste of food. And so in the case where you've got food that is considered to be holy, set apart, and for instance, you have it in an earthen vessel, well, that earthen vessel, it is believed, can absorb the taste of the food. And seeing that the food is holy, consequently, that vessel must be treated in accordance with halakhic principle. That is, it can't just be used for anything common from this point forward. It's deemed to be holy. So, of these things considered holy, things that absorb holiness will also be holy. And we're talking about vessels. Now, there is a midrashic tale that further illuminates this principle for us, but it also negates the idea that we can mingle the holy with the profane, because that's the first thing that popped in my mind when I'm reading this. How do you reconcile that? And so I found this story to be of interest. In the context of the story is about a young man who is listening to a learned rabbi teach the Torah, and at the same time is listening to people who teach against keeping the commandments of the Torah. And so when the rabbi confronts the young man about the danger of this, well, listening to these other people speak, here's what the young man says to him. I am not easily influenced. I come to you as well, but I have not become a chassid. In other words, look, you know, I'm listening to you, I'm listening to them, I'm not easily swayed by either one because I've been coming to you all this time and I haven't become a chassid. So the rabbi answers him and says this. There is a basic difference between the holy and the profane. Regarding holy meat, the Torah says, whatever touches it, its flesh becomes holy. And that's based on Leviticus 6, verse 20, which we will mention in a moment. But the sages explain that this applies only if the taste of the holy food was actually absorbed into the item touching it. But in the case of something that touches a contaminated item, even a mere touch is enough to contaminate. Let me draw the distinction for you. What he's saying is that the sages teach that if the thing that touches the holy food, if it only touches it, that's not enough to constitute becoming holy. That vessel has to absorb the taste, which would be inherently absorbing the holiness of that food. But the contrast to that is, all you have to do is to come in contact with something that's contaminated. You don't necessarily have to absorb it. All you have to do is come in contact with it, and even a mere touch is enough to contaminate you. And so the rabbi continues, with you, unfortunately, you have only touched holiness, but not absorbed it. You have already absorbed the contamination of your new friends. In short, what he's saying is, you're not internalizing these things. You're just coming in contact with it. You're not internalizing these things that we're teaching from the Torah. You're just kind of listening to it casually. And so you are not absorbing it. Therefore, you're not being considered holy. But on the flip side of that, you've already absorbed the contamination of this other teaching, of this other way of looking at things. And I found that extremely interesting. I found it very revelatory, because if you think about it, that is the issue. People who do not absorb the Word of God, they don't internalize it. In fact, in Exodus chapter 21, one of the things that God told Moses to tell the people when he gave them the Mishpatim, these certain judgments, that these were things that you were to instill within them, that they were to internalize. That would suggest to absorb, in a manner of speaking. So what my point is here, and I believe what the rabbi's point was, is based on what we read here in Leviticus about these different things that touch holy food, the essence of it is that these vessels absorb the set-apart qualities or the set-apart status to absorb the holiness. And when they do that, then they are considered to be holy. And so when the Creator says, I am holy, you be holy, what we see in that is absorb the holiness, absorb my word, get it into you, let it permeate your body, let it permeate your mind and your heart and your spirit. As a vessel, absorb all this into you, let it be part of who you are. So I found that to be very, very interesting. Which, if we read the Torah portion, we also see that you must be in a holy place to absorb or to internalize the holiness of this holy food, so to speak. And if absorbing holiness, that would suggest to me that you're going to be extremely hesitant to mingle with the profane. You're not going to be in places where it's going to be easy to come into contact with things that are contaminating. You're going to have to be in a holy place. Another thing that occurred to me in this is that eating unclean foods or that was offered to idols would be akin to absorbing the profane. And so you could understand why these people who were raised according to the parameters set down by the Torah would be very, very hesitant to go into anyone's house where unclean foods would be offered, where anything that would have been offered to idols would have been offered as food, because again, they're wanting to absorb holiness that comes forth from the Torah, and in these situations, they're going to come in contact with things that are considered to be profane. So now, later in this Torah portion, we're going to see, in fact, that earthen vessels that have absorbed the taste of the holy food are considered to be leftovers. And what I mean by that is there were these offerings that, for instance, one of them, they were given permission to eat it that night and the next day and on into the next night, but they couldn't eat it on the third day, and they had to burn all of it. And so this earthen vessel that absorbs the taste, if I can put it that way, of the holy food is considered to be leftover. And so then, like the meat offerings, it has to be destroyed where the meat offerings were burned, but this has to be destroyed due to its holy status, because it is not permitted to be used for anything else, and it's not to be just left laying around to be left over. It's holy. So I find that very, very interesting, in particular when you look at it, that perhaps he's talking about vessels such as you and me. When we have come to the understanding of the fact that the Creator is holy and that therefore we are, as his people, to be holy, then there is this concept, I guess, that you don't want to ever go back to the other way. It would be better if you'd never come to the way of knowing what's right than to come to it and then go back to the common and profane. And it's more difficult as the scripture teaches, for people who have known the truth and then to leave the truth and then to be able to come back to it than it is for people who never come to the truth and then to realize it. So I hope that makes sense. Now in chapter 7, we see the guilt and peace offerings covered. In verse 8 of chapter 7, in regard to the olah or the burnt offering, because all of it is consumed, we see in verse 8 that the priest who performs this act of offering the burnt offering, he is the one who will have the skin. He's the one who is going to obtain the hides. And the reason we bring this up, we covered it in detail in the previous Torah portion, but the reason we bring this up again is just to recognize that the burnt offering was a complete offering. Everything was consumed on the altar, and only the skins remained, and these skins were given to the priest who was attending to the work. Now, in verse 11, it mentions to us the peace offerings, the shalamim, and we see that the peace offerings in this Torah portion actually fall into three divisions. There's first the thanksgiving offering, and that is given in acknowledgement of deliverance from sickness or danger. We see the category of a fulfillment of a vow that is made in a time of distress. And then we see free will offerings when your heart is moved to remember the goodness of God. And so the thanksgiving, fulfilling a vow, and free will offerings. And the first of those categories, the thanksgiving, or in Hebrew, todah, that's a word that most of you are familiar with when you go to Israel and someone does something for you, you say todah or todah rabah. And in other words, you're saying, thank you very much. I do appreciate what you've done. So the todah offering or the thanksgiving offering is, again, given in acknowledgement of deliverance from sickness or danger or some kind of situation. And this offering, rabbinically anyway, is considered to be the supreme type of sacrifice. There is none higher as far as the rabbinical sources are concerned. In fact, they teach that in the Messianic era, all sacrifices are going to be complete in that what they have to teach is consummated. The only exception to this, they say, is the todah offering, the thanksgiving offering, but that will continue forever, so they say. Now, this is very interesting in consideration that we know the King Messiah, Yeshua, is going to reign from Jerusalem as king. And during that time, we have ample passages of Scripture suggesting to us that sacrifices and offerings are going to be made. Ezekiel is full of examples of that. But one in particular that I wanted to read to you is from Zechariah chapter 14, beginning at verse 16. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And if you know anything about Zechariah 14, this is after the Mount of Olives is split in two, when the Messiah returns and his feet stand on the Mount of Olives, according to other prophecies. When he returns, of course, he does battle with all the nations that have gathered against Jerusalem. And of course, the context of this one is after all that has taken place, and that everyone who's left of all those nations who came up to against Jerusalem are going to be coming up to Jerusalem again to worship the King at the Feast of Tabernacles. So that is the context of what I'm about to read to you from verse 20. In that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horses. The pots in the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yes, every pot in Jerusalem and Judah shall be holiness to the Lord of hosts. And everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them. In that day there shall no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Now the reason we read that is this is one example where we have sacrifices going on or offerings going on during the time of the Messianic era. And I don't know what that does to your theology, but nevertheless, here is this passage telling us there are going to be sacrifices. Now, you know, somebody would say, well, that's not going to be actual slaughter of animals. It's going to be this. It's going to be that. Well, the word that is translated sacrifices is the Hebrew word for slaughter, and specifically slaughtering an animal. So, I'm only bringing that out for this purpose. Rabbinic sages have taught that during the Messianic era, all the other sacrifices and what they are to teach you and me has been accomplished. And that, in their view anyway, the Todah offering is going to continue to be an offering because this is something that is given to God in acknowledgement of His delivering us from evil and from sickness and from danger and from death, etc. And so I would imagine that everybody who's there and able to go worship the King at the Feast of Tabernacles is really glad to have been delivered from everything that occurred. Now in verse 18, in talking about the peace offering and discussing that there are certain stipulations about how you offer it and how long you're permitted to eat of this meat that was not burned on the altar. If you go outside the parameters of what is stipulated there, in verse 18, it says that that becomes an abhorred thing. In Hebrew, it's pigul. And pigul is something that is disqualified. And so rabbinic commentary suggests that what this is really getting at is that while the service is actually being performed, that the offerer has improper thoughts, in this particular case, to eat the portion of meat beyond the time allowed. But the point that I wanted to make is that if something that is being offered and has the appearance of being a peace offering or a thanksgiving offering can become an abhorred thing if the person has improper thoughts. In fact, to do anything that contradicts the way you're to do it is going to invalidate the offering, and it's going to be regarded as abhorred. It seems to me that it would have almost been better not to bring it than to bring it and then to transgress the commandments that pertain to it and have it to be considered pigul or something that is detestable. And that person is going to be guilty. They're going to bear their iniquity in all this. So it's just kind of interesting to me that you have a situation where somebody's bringing something and it has the appearance of being good. It has the appearance of wanting to act benevolently, wanting to act with a heart of thanksgiving, and yet that thing can become abhorred. That thing can become so detestable to God that it's going to invalidate everything, and the person is now going to be guilty. Now, in verse 20, we are reminded again that one who is unclean should not eat of the peace offerings, the shalamim. And to do so means that they will be cut off from his people. In Hebrew, that is karet. Karet means spiritual excision. It's to be put away. And rabbinically, it's explained to be anything from exile to an untimely death, dying before your time or dying young. And so all these different opinions as to what karet actually is, but here's what it reminds us of, or at least this is what it reminds me of. Again, we mentioned this in the previous Torah portion, but it reminds us not to partake of the Lord's Supper unworthily. Remember, He is our peace, Paul writes, and he tells us that because some were partaking unworthily, some were sick, and he even said that some slept. So there is something too when God says something's considered to be holy. Here's how you're to treat that which is holy. And if you misappropriate, mistreat it, there are apparently consequences. Some are sick. Some even slept, Paul said. Now, in verse 23 and 4, we see that there is a prohibition against eating the fat of the ox or the sheep or the goat. Of course, these are the three sacrificial animals. And of these three sacrificial animals, whether they were consecrated or not, you are not to eat their fat. And rabbinically, it's believed that this prohibition involves animals that can be used as offerings. And that's why those three types are named. But they go on to say, other animals, such as deer, which are not going to be burned on the altar, the fat is permitted in those. So that reminds me of something I said in the previous Torah portion, which still holds true, I believe. And that is that, my understanding is anyway, that fats are usually where the toxins are stored up. And it's interesting that all these fats were burned on the altar. But when you have an animal, such as a deer, that's not going to be burned as an offering, then the fat is prohibited. Well, there's not a whole lot of fat in deer, typically. They're usually pretty lean, so a lot less toxins. And I just thought that would be worth noting. Now, in verse 26, we see that no blood ever is to be eaten in any of your dwelling places. In other words, this applies everywhere. You see, some prohibitions apply only to the land of Israel, but this is universal. No matter where you are, in Israel or in Tennessee, you are not to eat blood of any kind. And it mentions specifically from fowl or beast. The fact that fish is not mentioned, rabbinically it's interpreted to mean that the prohibition it does not apply where fish are concerned. In other words, the salting process that is used to draw the blood out of the meat is not utilized when it comes to fish. But Bill's midrash on that is, I wouldn't recommend eating raw fish anyway. Now in verse 29 and 30, it says that the person, the owner of the offering, is to bring it himself. Now when someone sins against a king, someone who's very noteworthy, someone who's high profile, has a lot of authority and power, and you sin against him, you don't just bring that person a gift as if to say, well, you know, let's just sweep everything under the rug, here's a gift. No, you seek his forgiveness first. Then when bringing tribute, it's an honor for that person and for the king, for that person to bring that tribute personally. But you first have to resolve anything that would disqualify the king from receiving your gift. In other words, again, if you sinned, then you go make that right. Then you bring your gift. And according to the Torah portion, this person is to bring the gift with his own hands. Now, he and the priest are going to share in the ritual of waving. And that is to say, the owner is going to take the prescribed portions and components of this offering that are going to be waved. He's going to hold it in his hands, and the fat and the breast in this particular case, he's going to hold it in his hands, and then the priest is going to place his hands under the owner's. So the priest is officiating more or less, but the person is actually participating in this as well. And that's important, I think, because if you're like me, for many years, I used to have this idea that the people would bring their offerings, they'd drop them off at the door of the tent, let the priest take care of it from there, and then they'd go on their merry way. Well, that's not the case. They participated in this process. Let me interject this. There's a lot of people in Christianity who take the approach of the way I saw people and how they brought their offerings. They show up in their church, and they kind of throw everything at the priest's doorstep or the pastor's doorstep or what have you. And, you know, they feel like it's their responsibility to teach me. I've done my civic duty. I've come here Sunday morning or Sunday night, or in some cases even Wednesday night for prayer meeting. But really, that's all I'm supposed to do. You take care of all the spiritual stuff. I'm just supposed to show up. Well, unfortunately, that's the way a lot of people look at it. But what we see in the Torah portion is no, that's not the way God sees it. God sees it, look, if you're going to do this, it's got to be because you're participating. This has got to represent you. This is not about the priest having a job. This is about you doing what you're supposed to do, and the priests are going to help you and lead you through the process because that's their ministry. But it doesn't change the fact that you have a responsibility to come. You're the one who is to offer it. In fact, the owner holds this wave offering in his hands, and the priest places his hands under the owner's. In this particular situation, the breast, we see, is given to the priest. And the breast represents where the heart is. Now, another portion we read about here is the right thigh, and that's lifted before the Lord. The breast represents the heart. Well, the right thigh represents the ability to move. And so your heart is supposed to be presented to God. And your ability to move, your ability to act on what's in your heart is to be lifted before the Lord or presented unto him. Now, there's a footnote to this, and that is the right thigh is considered to be the best part of the animal. And if you were having a feast and you were going to roast a goat, for instance, you would reserve the right thigh and give that to your guests. And an example of that is found in 1 Samuel chapter 9, when Samuel is hosting a feast for about 30 people, and he reserved the right leg or the right thigh for Saul, because Saul was considered to be the guest of honor. So I thought that was kind of interesting. There's a reason. Now, I won't say that I understand all the reasons, but there's a reason for the breast. There's a reason for the right thigh, etc. So now, at this point, it occurs to me that in the midst of all these particulars about right thighs and breasts and fat being lifted up and waved and this, that, and the other, that many Christians, they look at this, and they look at all these specifics, and this is where they would be tending to say that all this routine, all this rote, is what led to legalism. And it can't be argued that legalism and the lack of heart did develop in these practices. In fact, they became so religious in all of this that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. In other words, Yeshua had to come and to reinitiate the heart issue. But I want to suggest to you that Christianity has done likewise where Yeshua's sacrifice is concerned. If Israel of old did it with the sacrifices that God instituted here, Christianity has done the same thing where Yeshua's sacrifice is concerned. In other words, they have taken what was supposed to be about relationship and they've made it a religion, and there are routines and traditions that have spun off of that religious way of thinking, and it's no different than what Christianity views Israel is doing with all these different offerings that they were to make. In other words, what I'm getting at is, coming and approaching God and trying to draw near unto God has always been, and it will forever be, a matter of the heart. And that's the essence of what Yeshua did and showed us by example, that he followed God's instructions. He did what the Father said because he loved the Father. He and the Father are one, he said, and he's doing exactly what the Father would want him to do. Now, in chapter 8, we have the consecration of the priests. And by the way, I know I should point out that there's a lot of things that we're not going into because, as has been in past cases, there's a lot of things that are mentioned here in this Torah portion, but that we already covered in quite a bit of detail in the previous Torah portion. So that's why we're not going to every verse necessarily. We're just kind of hitting some of the highlights here and discussing some things that, you know, we haven't addressed yet. But at any rate, in chapter 8 of Leviticus, in our Torah portion, Tzav, we have the consecration of the priests, because this chapter is devoted to their consecration, Aaron and his sons. Literally in Hebrew, filling the hands of Aaron and his sons. Now in verse 5, we see Moses saying, as he's about to wash them and to put the vestments on them, he says, "This is the thing that the Lord commanded." What he's about to do is what God instructed him to do. Now, that's important to us because the sages say that Moses had the status of being a king and teacher. I understand that nobody anointed him king, but in the sense of his, how he was esteemed as the leader, he had the status of a king and he was a teacher. And yet, he humbles himself at this point by washing Aaron and his sons. Because you see, this is the thing that God commanded him to do. In other words, here is someone who is their leader, someone who is their teacher, yet he humbles himself by washing Aaron and his sons, because that's what God commanded him to do. So that's interesting to me, because on the night before his execution, here's what Yeshua did. He washed the feet of his disciples, and he said this in John chapter 13. "So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them.'" That's in John chapter 13, verses 12 through 17. And so here we have a situation where Moses is serving as high priest, because this is before Aaron and his sons are inaugurated. And so Moses is actually performing these duties. And so he is the high priest. But what is he doing? He's teaching Aaron and his sons what to do by doing it. He's teaching them by example. And to do that, in fact, he had to bring them to a specified place. He brought them. And he brings them to the place, and by example and by doing it himself, he is teaching them what they are soon to do. And so when the time comes for them to step into their calling, when it's that time for them to be inaugurated, here's the one who is high priest, if I can put it that way, who is their leader, who is their teacher, and yet humbles himself to wash them. And so Yeshua taught his disciples by example. They followed him around, they ate meals with him, they heard him teach, and he was teaching them by example. Why? Because the time was coming, and on the eve of his crucifixion, it was ever closer, he was going to inaugurate them, if I put it that way. As a matter of fact, he led them, or had them to go, to a specified place. He told them exactly where they're going to prepare the Passover. And then what do we see? Him as teacher and leader, humbling himself and washing their feet. Furthermore, upon their consecration, Aaron and his sons will eat a solemn meal. And Yeshua does this for his disciples, even as his disciples are preparing to eat a solemn meal. So Moses was initiating them into service, and their first service is going to be to God, and then secondly to the people. Because you see, we see this in Moses. Moses had faithfully served God first, and then he had served the people. And frankly, many times when the people didn't even realize that he was serving them. And likewise, Yeshua led by example, teaching how to serve God first and then one another. The first and great command, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and another like unto it, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And so he had been leading by example. Now the time has come for them to be inaugurated, if I can put it that way. And he is going to humble themselves as Moses did, and he's going to wash their feet. Now, generally, each time a priest would enter the court, he would wash only his hands and only his feet. Yet, what we read here in Leviticus 8, at the consecration, an actual immersion in a mikveh was called for. Now, I find that interesting because of some dialogue between Peter and Yeshua. In fact, in John chapter 13, before what we read just a moment ago, we see in verse 6 through 10, he's washing the feet of the disciple. And then he came to Simon Peter. And Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? And Yeshua answered and said to him, what I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this. Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. Yeshua answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my feet. Yeshua said to him, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not all of you. Now, the reason I find this interesting is because later on, Peter is going to be the one to write and say that we, those who have come into the knowledge of the Messiah, we are a royal priesthood. In fact, Yeshua told Peter, you don't understand what I'm doing right now, but you'll understand later. Now, in some way, according to what Yeshua said here, these men had already immersed themselves, if I can put it that way. That is, with the exception of Judas. And interestingly enough, Moses calls Aaron and his sons to the specified place. He consecrates them to establish them in the sight of all the people, by the way, that these are the ones that God has called. This is the thing that the Lord does. And just like we have a Judas among the disciples of Yeshua, it's interesting that later on we've got a man from the tribe of Levi, same tribe as Aaron and his sons, by the name of Korah, who is going to mount a rebellion. Now, in verse 12 of chapter 8, we see that Moses poured of the anointing oil onto the head of Aaron. And you'll notice that only the high priest had oil poured on him. Aaron and his sons both were sprinkled with oil, but only the high priest had oil poured on his head. And traditionally, it's said that Moses poured it on his head, then he placed some of the oil between his eyebrows, and then with his finger, he connected these two points of oil by forming a Greek chi, or the letter that looks like an X, or shall we say, a cross. Now, verse 14 through 15, we see that Moses slaughters the bull of the sin offering. Again, he is more or less functioning in the role of the high priest. Because Aaron and his sons, these priests, they had to be cleansed of any transgressions before they could help anybody else. And so Moses is the one who slaughters the bull of the sin offering. Now, if you look at the word Moshe, in Hebrew it's spelled Mem Shin He. It comes from the word Mem Shin He, pronounced Masha. Masha means to draw out of the water, of course we're told. So to draw out of the water, Masha. The reason this is interesting is it's linked phonetically to the word in Hebrew Mashach, which is spelled Mem Shin Het. So you have Mem Shin He and you have Mem Shin Het, and if you know anything about Hebrew, then you know that the sound is very similar. In fact, the way it's drawn in form, that is the letter He and the letter Het, are very similar. So the point is, the word Moshe, from which we get Moshe, is linked to the word Mashach, which, by the way, means to separate out. And from the word Mashach, we get the word Mashiach. And so Moses is functioning as the high priest. He is a prototype of the Messiah. And he is the one who had to humble himself to initiate those that he had been teaching by example into their service as priests. And so the picture, I think, is very plain to see. At least it is for me. Now in verse 22, one of the last things that we see as far as this consecration is the ram of inauguration. This was a special offering. This was a second ram, and it was a special offering specifically for the consecration of the priests. And this ram of inauguration was essentially a peace offering, but the word that is used for it is miluim, miluim, which literally means completion or the fullness. It's the completion of this consecration ritual. It's the fullness of it. And so, by extension, it is serving the same purpose as a shalamim, a peace offering, which was to arrange that or to attain that peace and that wholeness and completion between the offerer and between God. Now, it's interesting because the word miluim, which is spelled mem, lamed, aleph, yud, mem, is related to the word shalamim, which is peace offering. That's spelled shin, lamed, mem, yud, mem. This is interesting is because miluim comes from the word milah. Milah means complete or to be full. Shalamim comes from shalem, or whole. Everything as it's supposed to be. Here's why that's interesting. Because Yeshua, in Ephesians chapter 2, is regarded as being our peace. Because you see, he came to make the two, that is, uncircumcision and circumcision, one. He is our peace, if I can put it this way, shalem. And this joining the two, uncircumcision and circumcision, is exactly the same thing that Paul speaks of in Romans chapter 11 when he talks about the fullness of the Gentiles. In Hebrew, that would be milo hagoyim, and milo, or fullness, would be from the word milah. So in other words, this ram of inauguration, that's going to kind of culminate everything, or relate and connects the idea of something that is complete, something that is full, and with something that is whole, everything put back the way it's supposed to be. And that's exactly what Yeshua does. He is our peace. He comes to make the two one. He brings them together, breaking down the middle wall of separation, thus accomplishing the fullness of the nations that Paul refers to in Romans chapter 11. And two, the blood of this consecration ram is placed on the ear of the priest so that they can always hear God's command. It's placed on the thumb or of the right hand, symbolizing that they will be quick to carry out God's will, and it's on the big toe, the right foot, so they will move quickly to serve God. Now in verse 30, as we come to the close of the Torah portion, we see that oil and blood is sprinkled upon Aaron and his son's garments. And this is to typify their primary duties. Number one, to reflect the light of God's holiness and to diffuse it throughout the whole congregation. And two, to proclaim truth that God does, in fact, grant atonement for people who have repentant hearts. And so those were the two primary duties of the priesthood. Come to think of it, I think that's our two primary duties as well. To reflect His holiness and to proclaim the truth that God grants atonement for repentant people through the sacrifice of Yeshua the Messiah. And in verse 33 we see, it says that you shall be inaugurated. Literally, your hands shall be filled, speaking to Aaron and to his sons. And of course, in a literal sense, we see that they would have their hands filled with the offerings that the people were going to be bringing. But it is understood to be an idiomatic expression to say consecrated or inaugurated. In other words, it would be like us saying, this that I've had, now I'm going to put it in your hands. It's all in your hands now. You're the ones who are going to have to take care of it. And that is essentially what we see Moses doing where Aaron and his sons are concerned. This that I've had, this that I've been responsible for, now I'm putting it in your hands. And so Aaron and his sons are going to remain there in the Mishkan. They're going to remain there in the court for 7 days without leaving, so as not to be polluted by anything or anyone who's unclean. In fact, it was so emphatic that they do not get polluted or contaminated that God said, don't leave, that you die not. It was that strict. And rabbinically, the purpose for this staying there 7 days is because, in part, it was in preparation for what was to occur 7 days later. And in the next portion, we'll discuss the details of that. But as we kind of wrap this up, again, what we've done is we didn't read the whole Torah portion. We'll leave that to you. But we've hit some of the highlights and some of the things that jump out at us as far as what was significant about this particular Torah portion and trying to glean some principles and some concepts that we can apply into our own life. So I hope this has been beneficial for you. And I hope that you're enjoying these Torah portions. I'm certainly enjoying being able to study and to present the little bit that I'm learning from them. And so, again, I hope it's being beneficial for you. Thanks for joining me. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.